An Asian Enlightenment in Britain's Indian Ocean, 1860 to 1920, The Utopianism of Distant Communication. The year is 1892 in the colonial port city of Colombo, Ceylon. Ikkaduwe Sumangala, a celebrated Buddhist monk, has just published a new Pali grammar with commentary. The work is reviewed in the island's monthly literary journal, an English language periodical. The reviewer, who is critical, writes under the pseudonym Orientalist. But Ikkaduwe clearly has allies, for Orientalist's review is accompanied in the same edition by a rebuttal penned by another anonymous writer. This contributor, who takes the name Pali Scholar, writes about Buddhist monk Sumangala.
The graceful flow of the language and the masterly manner in which the work is written all combine to vindicate the often repeated assertion of men of great talent that he is really a mine of oriental lore.
In contrast, Pali Scholar writes of Sumangala's reviewer,
"Not seldom we find some pedants having a mere smattering of knowledge, appearing like a Caliban to torment Sumangala. One of them is our present critic, who has the arrogance to style himself as an Orientalist and who has most miserably blundered in his criticism."
Pali Scholar then lists the multiple errors made by Orientalist, which reveal a gross ignorance of Pali. But it is his final flourish that really deserves attention.
"Without the word more, I leave it to the Republic of Letters to judge of the mental caliber of this critic and to judge whether his remarks are or are not calculated to excite their risibility."
This brief literary kerfuffle might at first seem just a minor detail pulled from the neglected bottom drawer of colonial ephemera. But intriguingly, Pali Scholar was not alone in making grand allusions to a previous age of enlightenment. Some few years before, the spiritualist Madame Blavatsky and her American lieutenant Henry Steele Olcott informed Indian readers of their Theosophist magazine that they belonged to a rational
Republic of Conscience,
where all members had
an equal right to have the essential features of their religious belief laid before the tribunal of an impartial world.
As Theosophist readers, they were heirs to an enlightened legacy begun by Thomas Paine, author of The Rights of Man, who was one of
the great theosophical adepts.
Across the water in Singapore in the year 1900, English-educated Straits Chinese announced a new dawn of Chinese enlightenment by introducing their readers to China's Neo-Confucians, Kang Youwei and Liang Qichao. The doctor and Queen scholar Lim Boon Keng likened these thinkers to the French encyclopedists, for they
provided and encouraged the study of knowledge in all its branches.
Kang was cast as the leader of
a new school, which we may compare to the Parti des Philosophes, headed by Voltaire and kept a-going by the energetic D'Alembert. In the critical years of French history prior to the Great Revolution,
Asian language periodicals got in on the act too, likewise presenting the era as a new siècle de lumière. Reformist Muslim journals in Cairo and the Sumatran port of Padang took the Arab title Al-Manar or Al-Munir, meaning the illuminator. Meanwhile, in Calcutta, Colombo, and Bombay, the editors of other vernacular language magazines inserted the Sanskrit word bodh into their titles to represent themselves as journals of intellectual awakening. In the rest of this talk, we are going to travel across Britain's Indian Ocean, attempting to locate and account for Pali Scholar's Republic of Letters, a place where, behind their pen names, Asian literati felt confident enough to write back against so-called Orientalists, and to still receive a fair hearing from an open-minded tribunal. We will explore the transformations which contributed to this literary arena's emergence, we'll encounter some of the key participants who contributed to it, and we'll examine the significance of the ideas, languages, and values that were circulated across it. But before we do that, and in order to explain Pali Scholar's Republic of Letters better, we need to first turn to a rather more mundane world of steamships, railways, posts, and print. Part 1, The Rise of Postal Modernity. Pali scholars' reply to Orientalists in Colombo in 1893 was part of a broader defence of local religious authorities against colonial scholars, which included other contributions from Anglophone Ceylonese Tamils. Such writers were fully aware of adjacent vernacular literary publics, and the fully bilingual amongst them wrote for these readers too. Certainly, vernacular periodicals commanded wider local readerships at this time, but there was a reason for battling Orientalists in the English language press. Not only was this where Orientalists would be forced to read their critics, but these journals travelled much further than local Sinhala or Tamil organs, although these travelled too, to constitute the foundation of the Republic of Letters of which Pali scholars spoke. Ceylon's Monthly Register appeared as a supplement to the European-owned Ceylon Observer, which for 50 years had appeared in an additional weekly overland edition. By 1893, such summaries, originally posted home to Britain through the overland mail route across Suez, formed part of a series of press exchanges and relays that sustained a transoceanic circulation of news, opinions, reviews, and book extracts between Hong Kong, Singapore, Madras, Calcutta, Bombay, Lahore, and beyond. For Pali scholar and fellow literati, a regional as well as metropolitan readership could be grasped at, especially if their contributions in this cut-and-paste world of pre-syndication journalism were deemed worthy of further reprint. Of course, textual circuits and literary networks which spanned the Indian Ocean existed well before this. Nevertheless, what we mean by the sometimes overused terms network and circulation transformed in the later 19th century, as the reliability and the speed of maritime communications became revolutionized. This was the age of postal modernity. In the early 19th century, mails from Europe had taken between 5 and 8 months to reach Calcutta. In the middle decade of the century, they took between a month and 6 weeks. By 1900, the average transit time between London and Bombay via steamer and steam train was down to a fortnight. The Imperial Post Office of India recorded in 1903 that thrice weekly mail steamers connected Karachi with Bombay, Calcutta with Rangoon, and Madras with Rangoon. Services from Rangoon made the weekly, if not more than weekly, voyage down the coast to Penang and Singapore. Colombo was served by daily services that operated between it and the South Indian port of Tuticorin, and by daily P&O and British India steam navigation steamers that sailed to India, Chinese, and Australian ports. And so, if we accept the arguments of Michael Warner, the literary critic, historian, and social theorist, that publics are a relation between strangers, that they are fashioned through the repetitious circulation of discourse, the concatenation of texts through time, and that a punctuated and rhythmical exchange of texts enables norms of discourse to develop that offer confidence to this circulation, then it was during the late 19th century that such a regular tempo of distant communication emerged. In explaining this explosion in textual circulation, historians have thrown a lot of ingredients into the causal mix. Technological advances, including the emergence from around 1870 of Indian paper mills, expansion in education and literacy rates, often prompted by the needs of colonial business and colonial bureaucracy, the stimulus to print provided by rising nationalist sentiments. The great historian Chris Bailey, in his classic work Empire and Information, depicts a steadily increasing volume and intensity of textual exchange in early 19th century India, as printed works replace scribal publications, but the elites producing them stayed largely the same, as did the contents of these publications. Such exchange then rapidly escalated from around 1860 as the age of nationalist modernity swept across South Asia. Yet a somewhat different picture of this escalation emerges when we attempt to quantify it, which from the middle of the 19th century we are able to do through statistical data provided by the Imperial Post Office of India, which included Burma, and by the colonial blue books for Ceylon and the Strait Settlements. These sources reveal rapid surges in the amount of printed matter sent through the Imperial Post, which do not directly correspond to increasing literacy rates, measurable capitalist expansion, nationalist mobilization, or technological transfer. These surges correlate to dramatic shifts in imperial postal policy. The instigation in 1854 of an All India Penny Post to replace postage levied by distance. The introduction at around the same time of what would become an ever cheaper colonial postage for printed matter sent between Britain's Asian ports and also to Dutch and French Asian ports. This began at a rate four times cheaper than the equivalent postage for letters. Further reductions followed at the start of the 1870s and then 1880s as demand for such services skyrocketed. In all likelihood, the advent of cheap postal distribution was the most important factor hastening this regional transition from print patronage to genuine print capitalism. As one Calcutta journal observed, most vernacular Indian newspapers were, by the late 1870s, already distributed to their subscribers by mail. The arrival of the Indian penny post liberated these publishers from the tyranny of distance. Mail order print had a similar impact on the book trade. Colonial book catalogues and registers from Bengal revealed the sudden surge in book production from the mid-1850s. Publishers increasingly advertised and serialized their books in periodicals. Some offered reduced or waived postage to their customers, or in the case of Lahore's Nawal Kishore Press, occupied offices immediately adjacent to the main post office. Meanwhile, cheap colonial postage allowed publishers to reach transoceanic readerships. Singapore, which from the 1870s had been a distribution centre for Islamic texts that arrived from Mecca, Cairo and Bombay, transformed into a publishing centre in its own right, one which especially fed the Malay reading public of the Dutch East Indies and beyond. By 1900, the city's publishers began to post out free catalogues, overland and overseas, to customers who wrote to request them. Detailed instructions were provided for readers in Java and Sumatra as to how to order their books, right down to the rate at which their rupiah would be converted into Straits dollars. The original works being published in Singapore included, from the 1890s, Romanized Malay translations of Chinese classics, which were aimed at Malay-speaking Peranakan, that is to say local-born Chinese. This was a relatively small readership, yet it proved a strikingly long-distance one. Readers of Chan Kim Boon's Malay translation of Sang Guo Zhe Yang Yi, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, could be found not only in the Straits settlements and across the Dutch East Indies, but in Saigon and Guangdong and Fuzhou. Basically, wherever Peranakan Chinese had a business presence. But Chan's Three Kingdoms is also indicative of a further change. It appeared in 30 monthly volumes at a price of one Spanish dollar each. It was filled with illustrations, photographs, readers' letters, including on points of translation, news reports, especially about the Sino-Japanese War of 1894-95, jokes, brain teasers, and even recipes. It was, in effect, as much a popular magazine, although at an average size of 150 pages per instalment, quite a hefty one. But this was the age of serialization, of small formats which publishers could send quickly at the cheapest rates of imperial postage, cutting their losses if the first number failed to produce a financial return. The postal distribution of print had a striking impact on its material form, as the pamphlet, the chapbook, and the serial came to dominate. Readers, fully confident in the regular circulation of these small formats, would frequently bind them together themselves to form the full works of which the instalment was but a part. Before we explore the contents of such works in more detail, two points are worth signalling. First, the era of postal modernity in Britain's Indian Ocean witnessed a parallel explosion of written correspondence. In each case, the colonial records we cited earlier show that postage reductions generated parallel surges in the transmission of letters. In the mid-1850s in India, for example, or later in the 1880s in the Straits settlements. Most importantly, this widening epistolary habit was not confined to literary elites. Singapore's Straits Times in 1909, for example, reported that 890,000 so-called coolie letters had been sent to China from the colony the previous year, an average of 3.2 letters per inhabitant of Chinese nationality, the same paper observed. After 1910, the total passed the 1 million mark. In 1920, a senior postal official in India commented that the Indian post office was,
largely used by people who can neither read nor write. And this is made possible by the existence of professional letter writers who are to be found in every town and village of the country.
Distant communication had become democratized. And this leads us to our second connected point. As we shall see, the learned literati who constituted Pali Scholars' Republic of Letters were not writing in a vacuum. They were writing and indeed reading in response to and often against the burst of popular writing and communication they witnessed around them. They were not the only producers of text. In fact, purely in terms of the bulk of written matter shipped across the seas at this time, their literary output was relatively minor. This was a reality that would weigh heavily on their often brilliant minds. Part 2. Discoveries Across Distance. When we explore the kinds of texts that, from the 1860s, moved in greater number and with greater frequency across the Indian Ocean, an often repeated but still worth repeating point emerges. The imagined communities generated by the diffusion of print extended beyond the colonial boundaries that later defined modern nation-states. The 1880s proved the critical decade in the emergence of diasporic periodicals, as print followed the oceanic crossings of migrants, both rich and poor. In 1882, the Indian editors of The Hindu, an English-language newspaper in Madras, established its Tamil sister paper, Swadesha Mitran, which subsequently claimed a readership in the Dutch East Indies, Siam, Indochina, indeed everywhere that Tamils had migrated. In Singapore in 1881, Peranakan, that is local-born Chinese, joined with China-born journalists to commence publication of the Lat Pao, or in Mandarin Le Bao, literally the Straits Paper, which developed a network of 800 subscribers spread out from Burma to Java to Indochina. In the same decade in Java and then in Singapore in the 1890s, Peranakan Chinese became involved in Romanized Malay journalistic enterprises. Mail exchanges across the seas gave birth to a transnational Malay-reading Chinese public that encompassed subscribers in Padang, Palembang, Singapore, Penang, Malacca, and Batavia. From around 1910 until the outbreak of World War II, China-born migrants across Southeast Asia began to receive, often for free, Chiaokan, that is, home village news, that is to say, printed newsletters, newspapers, and magazines published by individuals, clans, schools, villages, and government offices in these readers' ancestral Chinese homelands. Typically, these periodicals appealed to a transnational yet narrow reading public, one defined not by nation but by clan, village, or dialect group. These overseas Tamil and Chinese newspapers became lenses through which their readers discovered the geography of the diaspora to which they belonged. During the 1930s, for example, Tamil newspapers in the Strait Settlements and Malaya provided particularly specific details of a Tamil community that stretched from South Africa to Fiji. Correspondents in these journals often expressed their delight at the role of print in having made possible such discoveries. Within these new geographies, new focal points emerge that shifted their readers' orientations. In Jaffna, on the island of Ceylon, the overseas circulation of Tamil news established Madras, rather than Colombo, as the primary political reference point for Tamil readers from the island. It may have likewise projected Penang, to quote historian Sunil Amrith, as the second city of Tamil Nadu. From the mid-1890s, news reports in Java, focusing on the achievements of Singapore's Straits Chinese, established this city as the epitome of Chinese enlightenment, the gateway, so one Java-born Chinese reformer put it, to a wider and more progressive Chinese world. The sacred geographies of pious readers were likewise extended, cemented, and revitalized. Stories of Muslim saints from Persia and Iraq published in Bombay were distributed via the ports of Bandar Abbas, Bushire, Basra, Madras, Durban, and Singapore to Arabic, Persian, Swahili, Tamil, and Malay readers. These stories, which often took the form of chapbook hagiographies, which depicted the enchanted landscapes where various Sufi sheikhs had performed miraculous acts, played a key part in the popularization of contemporary pilgrimage sites. La, 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 la. Likewise, Tamil literati in Ceylon drew on bhakti traditions to print works of devotional sacred geography that united their island with southern India in a unitary Hindu ecumene. The pages of such works, which usually appeared as pamphlets or chapbooks, might be devoted to Shiva in the Koneswaram temple in Trincomalee, to Murugan Sikanda at Katargama in the south of the island of Ceylon, to Murugan Supramaniam in the name of Shiva across the Gulf of Mana in the Turachendur temple on Tuticorin beach, or to Vishnu in the Tirumula Venkat Ishwara temple in southern Andhra Pradesh. In Colombo, Sinhala and English Buddhist periodicals saturated their readerships with pious travelogues, especially following the pioneering pilgrimage of the city's Buddhist reformer Anagarika Dharmapala, who visited the Mahabodhi Temple in India in 1891. For certain Buddhist editors, the ocean-crossing periodical became itself the tool by which the ancient Buddhist ecumene might be revitalized. In 1903, for instance, the editor of the Buddhism magazine from Rangoon proclaimed its intention to provide a
platform where all may meet and speak of their work and hopes to all their brothers.
But there was also an explicit millenarian expectation behind such work.
It is our deepest hope that with this common platform as a beginning, we may help in time to bring about an union of the Buddhist peoples, a federalization of all Buddhist work. For when that aim is accomplished and the huge forces of Buddhism stand as one, then at last the sleeper of the ages shall awaken to proclaim once more the law of righteousness and truth to all the earth and to lighten the footsteps of mankind into the way of peace.
So in some ways, the term imagined communities, coined by Benedict Anderson, obscures the extent to which, while remaining distant, these were also very tangible communities in which participation went beyond the act of reading. Editors regularly demanded of their readers further signs of commitment to the publics that their journals were producing. Readers were expected to become contributors, distributors, and sales agents. Journals became the foci for transnational fundraising efforts, either for the organ itself or for some wider community cause, such as temple restorations, educational scholarships, or humanitarian aid. Subscriptions became badges of belonging to the transnational communities these periodicals sought to represent. Several editors located their dispersed readerships and recorded their growth by including updated patron and subscriber lists in each new edition. In 1880, the editors of The Theosophist celebrated its inclusive and cosmopolitan readership by declaring that it should be rightly called the
Asiatic People's Magazine,
for its mailing register proved it was
a regular visitor at some hundreds of towns and cities situate in the four quarters of the globe, with subscribers of every sect and caste, and not preponderatingly of any particular one.
Many journals provided instructions to their subscribers on how to behave as enlightened members of the new communities they had now, through the act of reading, joined. The Theosophist advised its members on how best to be a Theosophist. That is to say, how to be a genuine member of this, quote, truly republican and cosmopolitan body. The Madras English Tamil Telugu magazine Sri Dharma, which from 1918 served as the organ of the Women's Indian Association, the WIA, was another fine example. Though the journal's editors were all European women, its Indian language articles, typically beginning with the welcome, Dear Sister, and intended to be read aloud, summarised key women's issues and instructed readers to set up meetings to discuss them. Sri Dharma functioned as a public-making manual. Its readers were told to imagine themselves forming part of a global feminist sisterhood.
We are sisters in a great family, bound together by mutual desire to help each other and to do something for the welfare of humanity. And so we greet each other through the medium of the pages of this, our first paper.
Part 3. Looking at Great Mirrors, the Rise of Critical Publics. A feature of the textual efflorescence we have been exploring is the almost simultaneous rise in the decades that straddled the turn of the 20th century of critical transnational publics. Sri Dharma, which we have just explored, followed in the footsteps of a wave of reformist periodicals. In Cairo, for example, in 1898, the Muslim reformer Rashid Rida established his progressive Al-Manar, the Illuminator journal. Translations of its articles into Malay became a staple of the Singapore reformist Al-Imam, the religious leader magazine, founded in 1906. A critical transnational Buddhist public emerged slightly earlier, but reached its apex in the years immediately after 1900. Anagarika Dhammapala was again one of the key instigators. He established his Mahabodhi journal, originally published from Calcutta, to reach out to Buddhists, quote, whether in Siam, Japan, or Ceylon, who had previously localized their energies. When, in the following decades, a new crop of Rangoon-based Buddhist periodicals began publication, they gave rise to an informal Theravadan press syndicate, one which linked critical Buddhist readers at opposite ends of the Bay of Bengal. Meanwhile, from the middle of the 1890s, Singapore's Chinese reformers, both local-born and China-born, began to flex their critical muscles. Critical discussions that called for a reform of Chinese customs commenced through the Cross Straits Romanized Malay Press Network and through new Chinese language periodicals. Indeed, in the early 1900s, the city became something of an emporium for transnational reform, as Neo-Confucians, Buddhist modernists, Theosophists, and Muslim progressives all used it as a base for their global ventures. At the same time, we need to be wary of assigning too great a role to circulating print as the singular catalyst for this near-simultaneous critical awakening. As the historian Niall Green has argued, print was a neutral technology that both customary and modernist-minded literati exploited alike. But when explaining these parallel developments, what is clear is the overlapping nature of the modernist discourses being articulated. Theosophists, modernist Buddhists, reformist Muslims, and Chinese Neo-Confucians all coupled their concern to spread modern education with their desire to promote the study and distribution of classic sacred texts. All were similarly preoccupied in their various ways with the challenge of European Enlightenment rationalism. The Buddhist anti-superstition drive led from Colombo was paralleled by its Neo-Confucian counterpart launched from Singapore. Progressives in Madras, Colombo, and Singapore near simultaneously pushed for female education. Anagarika Dhammapala and Lim Boon Keng, writing in the first case from Colombo and Calcutta and in the second from Singapore, were obsessed with modern thinking about hygiene. Both declared their respective belief systems, Buddhism and Confucianism, to be rational and, quote, scientific. Along with India's Vivekananda, they all held that the reformed versions of their religions, which they advocated, were superior to Christianity because each embodied and indeed foretold Darwin's theory of evolution. What becomes furthermore clear are the transnational dynamics that produce these parallel modernist movements. Certainly it's true that they were all led by a new generation of Western-educated Asian bourgeoisie who were keen to respond to Christian missionary activity. This was the common local context, but to an extent that scholars perhaps have so far missed, these reform programs were at the same time connected through the wider Republic of Letters. As the leaders of these movements exchanged ideas, looked sideways to learn from reformist competitors and rivals, and felt the need to keep in step with these progressive Joneses located across the seas. When, for instance, in 1899, Christian missionaries chided Lim Boon Keng in Singapore's press for a Confucian reform that merely imitated, they claimed, India's Brahmo Samaj and the Buddhist modernism in Ceylon being advocated by Dharmapala, Lim happily admitted that he knew of these movements and had indeed studied them. A few years earlier, his chief Confucian co-worker, the journalist Tan Teck Soon, interviewed Dharmapala at the offices of the newspaper Tan had founded. Confucianism would always remain Tan's true and first love, but this didn't stop him becoming, clearly impressed by Dharmapala, the Singapore representative for the Ceylonese Buddhist Mahabodhi Society. And it wasn't simply ideas that were being borrowed and imitated. Educational practices, organizational techniques, and repertoires of contention were freely exchanged, adopted, and adapted. In the 1890s, local-born Chinese in Java followed their cousins in the Straits settlements by building Anglo-Chinese schools, a striking development if we remember that this was, after all, the Dutch East Indies. Modern textbooks for these new schools were imported straight from Singapore. In Rangoon, Buddhist journals monitored the increasingly popular temperance movement launched in Ceylon after 1906 and exhorted Burmese Buddhists to learn from it and raise a simultaneous campaign, which eventually they did. The British response to this connected agitation was held up to comparative transnational scrutiny. One Buddhist journal in Colombo criticized the inconsistencies in a colonial policy that meant Burmese temperance workers received official support, while those in Ceylon met only with government obstruction. The distance that these reformers travelled intellectually in pursuit of modernist inspiration, not to mention their openness to other religions and ethnicities, was at times remarkable. Evidence that Britain's Indian Ocean was becoming awash with competing modernities from which the enlightened leader could pick and choose comes in the form of an article that appeared in Singapore's reformist Al Imam Malay Journal in 1908. In An Exposition Concerning the Malays, our anonymous author seeks to encourage Malay readers to, quote, practice self-improvement by the use of a great mirror.
It can be seen that our current Malay writers mention, in various newspapers and histories, how all sorts of Malays, whether from the end of Selang to the Tanjung Romania, are, metaphorically speaking, looking at great mirrors, including the Mikado Mutsuhito and the ascent of the Japanese race. Or they look at the fall and weakness of China, the fading of Egypt, or the exceptions made by His Excellency the late Abu Bakr and his modern state of Johor and its like.
It soon becomes evident that the late Sultan Abu Bakr of Johor is, in the writer's eyes, the paragon of enlightened Islamic leadership.
His late excellency had erased all the despicable qualities of the Malays from his heart by cultivating the benefits of human civilization. This he realized by travelling, not just to England, but to China, Japan, the Malay Peninsula, Java. Outwardly, he was just taking time on holiday, yet his heart was filled with the intention to work and strive for just such an elevation of the Malay people, even as the Japanese nation had done, and the Chinese are now doing, rousing from their slumber.
Through what the author next describes as the process of comparing and discerning the most attractive and fitting actions of the nations of the world, Abu Bakr eventually determined that the Japanese nation was the best overseas exemplar. The anonymous author then himself commends the, quote, freedom, sturdiness, civilized ways, knowledge, skill, and wisdom of Japan. He even refers his readers to a book entitled Al-Shams al-Mushrika, The Rising Sun, by which his audience might study this enlightened nation. Part 4. Babel or Cosmopolis, the Age of Translation. The author of Al-Shams al-Mushrika, The Rising Sun, was the Egyptian nationalist Mustafa Kemal. His book had originally been published in Arabic in Cairo in 1904 before becoming available in Singapore in a Malay translation a mere 2 years later. That a Malay Muslim journal in the Straits Settlements could direct its readers to the example of modern Japan via translation of an Arabic work originally published in Egypt tells us all in one sense that we need to know about this Republic of Letters. It might be tempting, as some have done, to imagine the Indian Ocean as a textual Babel, but the publics which addressed each other across it during this period overlapped and intersected. For this was an era of enlightened eclecticism, sociability, and most important of all, translation. Across the British Indian Ocean, Asian literati had the habit of dropping in on each other's forums. At one extreme, such sociability was driven by intellectual admiration and ambition. But such sociability and collaboration was also born out of necessity. When Lim Boon Keng's fellow Chinese reformers in Singapore commenced publication of a romanized Malay newspaper, they needed the help of the Malay writer Muhammad Ibrahim, son of perhaps the most renowned Malay writer of the 19th century, Munshi Abdullah. Muhammad Ibrahim helped local-born Chinese literati gain access to the Malay press printed in Jawi, that is, Persian Arabic script, which few local-born Chinese at this time had a command of. In South Asia and beyond, Indian and Ceylonese newspaper editors attempted to produce bilingual and even multilingual editions before typically opting to print separate sister editions in English and their chosen vernaculars. From Durban, South Africa, for example, Gandhi initially commenced publication of his Indian Opinion newspaper as an English, Gujarati, Tamil, and Hindi organ. This embrace of polyglossia was likewise driven by the global ambitions of the region's religious reformers and modernizers, their desire to reach as wide an audience as possible. There are many examples that can be drawn from across the British Indian Ocean, but perhaps the most significant occurred in Madras. From here, the Theosophical Society, pursuing universal brotherhood and the revival of so-called Aryan religion and science, extended its branches from South Africa to the rest of India, to Ceylon, Burma, and the Dutch East Indies. This elongated chain of textual exchange gave rise to one of the world's greatest translation networks. Local pundits and bhikkhus in India and Ceylon were enlisted to work on English translations of sacred Sanskrit and Pali texts. The society's translation of the Bhagavad Gita and its English language Buddhist and Hindu religious manuals went on to sell in their hundreds of thousands, enjoying such popularity that even Gandhi over in Natal would try his luck with a cheap pirated edition of Annie Besant's Gita. But the full impact of the Theosophical Society was felt when its mammoth translation at work shifted gear into reverse. In 1881, the year that the English edition of Olcott's Buddhist Catechism was published, Sinhalese patrons of the Theosophical Society funded a Sinhala edition. A Japanese version followed 5 years later, and then a Tamil and Burmese translation. In India, Indian Theosophists translated Theosophical publications into Hindi, Tamil, Telugu, Kannada, Gujarati, and several other Indian languages, all of which were sold in cheap small format editions. In particular, the translations and commentaries of Annie Besant, the Society's president, achieved an often spectacular vernacular afterlife. Equally, it was the exigencies of competitive print capitalism that encouraged these literati to reach out and engage with polyglot readerships. Translation was clearly profitable and a viable commercial strategy. For example, the profits that the Theosophical Society earned from its cheap vernacular editions of Hindu catechisms enabled it to open the Theosophical Publishing House in Madras in 1908 as a fully commercial enterprise. Elsewhere, translation efforts made the careers of upcoming Asian literati as they turned to popular satire and drama. Colombo provides an excellent example in the career of the Western-educated Sinhalese playwright John De Silva. Having toiled as a government printer in Colombo, De Silva in the early 1880s turned to writing plays. At that time, the popularity of a touring Bombay Parsi theatre troupe had unleashed a wave of demand for similar exotic dramas in Sinhala and for printed Sinhala versions of these tales. De Silva played his part in the surge of popular print that met this demand. He and his fellow multilingual literati cannibalized works in English and other languages to which they had access to produce, amongst others, cheap Sinhala retellings of the Arabian Nights,
the Ramayana and the Mahabharata,
or staples of the Parsi theatre repertoire. De Silva went on to produce Sinhala translations of Gulliver's Travels, Robinson Crusoe, Romeo and Juliet, and numerous other plays by Shakespeare. It was only later that he became the self-consciously nationalist playwright that he is remembered as in Sri Lanka today. When returning to write for the theatre in the early 1900s, he sought to wean popular tastes away from the exotic and the foreign and back to the patriotic. Yet even in this new incarnation, De Silva continued to translate Shakespeare, regarding the great bard as a universal master whom all humanity had a right to claim, just as the Caliban-citing Pali scholar with whom we started this journey might have. And it's here in this fervour of populist profit-making print, this flurry of texts that travelled back and forth across the ocean, straddling and surmounting territorial and linguistic boundaries, propelled onwards by the public taste for gossip, magic, mystery, exoticism, sensuality and scandal, not to mention by the older controversies unleashed by religious polemicists, that we begin to define the contours of Pali scholars' enlightened republic of letters. Not by understanding it simply as a compartmentalized parade ground for irrationality performed in front of an all-seeing colonial eye, but rather as a reaction to the wider, vernacular, popular textual tempest. For as we shall now try to prove in the final part of this talk, while some Asian literati immerse themselves in the possibilities for power and profit which the rampant circulation of print opened up, others balked at the prospect, came to define themselves in contradistinction to it, and sought out a refuge in a seemingly higher plane of discourse. Part 5. The Rise of Enlightened Reading. South Africa, 1909. Gandhi publishes the first version of Hind Swaraj, his anti-Western polemic, in Gujarati. In it, he depicts cheap print and cheap imperial postage, which we have argued to have been the key foundations of an Asian Republic of Letters, as twin evils of modern civilization.
Formerly, men wrote books that are most valuable. Now, anybody writes and prints anything he likes and poisons people's minds. Formerly, much expense was incurred in order to send letters. Today, anyone can abuse his fellow by means of a letter for one penny.
As Isabel Hoffmeyer has argued, Hind Swaraj was Gandhi's response to the unbridled passions he believed print to have generated by the start of the new century, his attempt to provide the vulnerable Indian reader with a new manual for slow and reasoned reading. In the dialogue Hind Swaraj presents, the character of the editor guides the reader through the dangerous literary morass around him, towards safety and ultimately awakening, all the while teaching the reader where to pause, to consider, and to reflect. Gandhi's concerns about enlightened reading and reflection encapsulated those of a generation of Asian intellectuals from across the Indian Ocean world. In Calcutta from the 1860s, Banguli Bhadralok wrote to thwart the influence of what they deemed low populist literature, namely the cheapened so-called vulgar publications that were pumped out by the publishers of the city's Batala neighbourhood. As the historian Tapti Roy has put it, the genteel contributors to Bhadralok periodicals sought to discipline the world of the printed word from within. Across India and Ceylon, a host of periodicals appeared that declared their mission to pursue the deliberate and rational discussion of literary, religious, political, and scientific topics, and that claimed to belong to cosmopolitan publics who abided by enlightened ideals of tolerance and reasonableness. Their diverse readerships were instructed to conduct all their discussions in a, quote, spirit of research. Religious controversies and sectarian propaganda were prohibited. A number of these editors found inspiration for their journals in the Spectator papers of Addison and Steele. Indian Muslim reformer Syed Ahmed Khan, having discovered the Spectator on a visit to England in 1869, commenced publication of his Urdu journal, Tadib al-Akhlaq, Refinement in Morals, the following year. Within it, he championed the reasoned discussion of science, politics, and religion, on one occasion citing Newtonian laws in an exhortation to his readers that they rediscover the historical Muslim notion of freedom of opinion. This self-conscious emulation of enlightened discursive ideals extended to the way some editors manage their publications. We've already discussed the importance of postal subscriptions to the fashioning of new enlightened publics. At a more mundane level, subscriptions allowed editors and publishers to reduce their reliance on advertising revenue, and so further assert their journal's progressive credentials. Gandhi's Indian Opinion newspaper, for example, initially featured advertisements, but these presented the future Mahatma with what he termed the constant difficulty in deciding which to accept. In early 1906, with the paper's readership extending from Natal and Cape Town to the coasts of Mozambique and Gujarat, The View commended itself, so Gandhi recalled, that since this organ was intended to serve rather than make a profit, it ought to finance itself through subscriptions alone. The immediate effect of this new policy, he went on, was that a
change came over the internal strength and character of paper, and it became a force to reckon with. The Indian community realized at once their proprietorship of Indian opinion and their consequent responsibility for maintaining it.
Some years later in Calcutta, the Bangla monthly Sabujpatra, Green Leaves, likewise avowed its progressive character by banning from its pages not just advertisements, but images altogether. Key enlightened behaviours were coming to define this oceanic republic of letters, the disavowal of superstition, the rejection of sectarianism, the retreat from scandal, consumerism and sensuality, the commitment to reasoned discourse and literary refinement. What is more, an increasing number of physical spaces were coming into existence which embodied these ideals and which stood as beacons for those Asian literati able to voyage across the seas in pursuit of enlightenment. The self-starred cosmopolitan clubs, for example, of Bombay, Calcutta, Colombo, Rangoon, and Madras. In the Madras Cosmopolitan Club, one observer remarked, visiting luminaries were paraded in front of a resident Indian intelligentsia that covered every shade of contemporary opinion. The colourful literary and artistic salons, such as that within the Tagore's Calcutta residence at Jorasanko, provide another example. So too do the reading rooms and the debating halls of theosophical lodges, all of which proclaim their commitment to the principle of universal brotherhood. And then there were the modern universities. Colleges and ashrams, which provided the critical student audience sufficient to sustain a nascent oceanic lecture circuit. And this is not to forget the numerous literary and social reform clubs, which maintain lists of overseas corresponding members and which, in the case of Lim Boon Keng's
Philomathic Society in Singapore helpfully positioned translators in the audience for those visitors unable to follow debates conducted in various Chinese dialects. And finally, we have the printing presses, the newspaper rooms, which advertise themselves as international, in the case of Gandhi's press in Natal, or in the case of the Hindus' national press in Madras, became the focus for regular in-house debates between Brahmins and non-Brahmins, Hindus and non-Hindus, theosophists and Christians, all united by their interest in progress. It does seem important that we recognize the impact that these enlightened bourgeois spaces had, with their common dedication to cosmopolitan sociability, on the changing nature of intellectual authority in the British Indian Ocean of this time. We've noted that an intensified circulation of print hardly made the decline of customary authority inevitable. But what it may have contributed to was the emergence of an elitist public sphere that self-organized and self-defined itself through its adherence to collective rationality, a common arena of learned debate in which, for a moment in time at least, caste, race, or religion hardly seemed to matter or create a barrier. On the one hand, this was an age where, as Gandhi noted, anyone can abuse his fellow through a one penny letter. On the other hand, this was an era where distance, difference, and sometimes even anonymity encouraged utopian expressions of fraternity. How all of this relates to the near simultaneous rise of anti-colonial nationalism at this time is another important and highly complex story. But I want to finish now by us hearing one more time those utopian imaginings of the editors of the Theosophist magazine.
The parent society is, in one word, a republic of conscience, a brotherhood of men in search of the absolute truth. Every one of us professes to be ready to help the other, whatever the branch of science or religion to which his personal predilections may lead him. We have presidents who are severally Christian, deist, Buddhist, Hindu, and atheist. None dogmatizers, none claiming to be wiser or more infallible than the other, yet each taking the other by the hand, calling him brother, and helping him, and being helped in the divine quest after knowledge.